Good afternoon, everyone. I will call to order this House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development Committee meeting Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. Representative Kennemer, I would be more than happy to move your bill first if you would like to join us. That would be fine. And on that note, I will open a hearing on House Bill 2614 and welcome Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Today, I'm here with regards to House Bill 2614, and it comes at the request of one of my constituents, the Boring Water District. I didn't think of water as boring, but you never know.
Never boring.
And things are not always boring and boring, unfortunately, because the situation was that there is a rule about the delivery of gasoline to special districts, and it requires 900 gallons. And at one point, Boring, according to the director who requested this bill, who unfortunately is not able to be with us this afternoon, you're required to buy 900 gallons per year. And Boring got in deep trouble for having 888.
Oh, my goodness.
Because of this grievous error, and also Mr. Landauer, I think, has they tried to work on it. I think they got within 2 gallons, but they were still deficient. And it seems to me that we've lost track of what we're trying to do here and gotten lost in the details instead of trying to have gasoline available for these special vehicles. And let's see, with me, as I've already said, is Mark Landauer at the Special Districts. And also, I think he will be preparing and presenting to you an amendment because there's been a request by the ports. They have some similar problems. So if I could, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Landauer to finish up our comments.
Mr. Landauer, well, good welcome afternoon. To our committee.
Good afternoon, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Special districts are single service governments, and we have approximately 950 special districts throughout the state of Oregon. Current law presently prohibits any person, of course, other than the owner, operator, or employee, to use or manipulate any pump, hose, pipe, or other device for the dispensation of a Class 1 flammable liquid. Of course, we're talking about gasoline. However, there are a few exceptions. And one of those exceptions, of course, is if a person is a non-retail customer and purchases at least 900 gallons of gas during a 12-month period. There are some other exceptions as well. Those exceptions include local governments that provide either fire, police, or ambulance services. As Representative Kennemer mentioned, we had a local government that typically was purchasing a little in excess of 900 gallons a year. One year, they fell short. And as a result of falling short, Boring Water being not serving or not providing a fire or an ambulance or a police service, thereby became ineligible to participate in the card lock system. This measure before you today would allow several types of special districts to be exempted from the 900-gallon floor, if you will, in order to be eligible to participate in the card lock system. Why is this important? It's important because many of the districts that you have listed before you in House Bill 2614 provide some type of an emergency response. Needless to say, an electric PUD wires an electricity go out in the middle of the night. Needless to say, not all retail gas dispensing facilities are open in the middle of the night, thereby necessitating or the need for access to fuel. And the list is pretty similar for a water district, Obviously, water mains typically break in the night when it's cold. Another example was Mass Transit District. Well, why would they need card lock system? They probably already are purchasing more than 900 gallons. Well, let's just be imaginative, if you will, and there's a catastrophe. You need to deploy all your buses. It's at night. You need to move people, so on and so forth. So this added flexibility of having access to the card lock system can be very important to some of these special districts. Currently, the bill before you today does not include ports, and the chair of the committee asked if I would reach out to some of the ports to see whether or not this would be helpful to them. And the response that I got, by and large, was yes, indeed it would be. And for a couple examples, I would like to just share with you the Port of the Dalles, obviously along the Columbia River. Their port district is approximately 270 square miles. That port district on the southern end of the district has no retail gas facilities whatsoever. In the event of an emergency, when they have to deploy staff, maintenance staff, they would have no access to gasoline unless they were eligible for the card lock system, because lo and behold, there is a card lock system in the southern end of their port. There are some other examples. I don't want to belabor this. I don't get the sense that I'm getting too many skeptical looks here. But nevertheless, I could share with you several other examples. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Landauer. Seems pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward.
All right. Representative Kennemer, anything else to add?
Thank you much. Very tough bill. I'm hoping
all
you'll...
Right. For anyone else...
Mr. Landauer will work on an amendment and get that to you promptly, and we'd
Sounds
love
great.
To have this come on out of committee and get this modest little measure resolved. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you,
the
Representative Kennemer,
for
bringing this to our attention. I think a lot of our rural, smaller districts are going to appreciate this amendment. So thank
Indeed.
You. Or this bill and this amendment.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else would like to speak to this very simple bill? I'm going to close the hearing on 2614.
Senator Edwards' staff is going to get him as we speak to come to the bill.
Okay. Do we want to do 2264 since they're in the room? Elsie.
I think how soon before Senator Edwards gets here? If he's on his way, I think we'll move along
sure.
with him.
On some of the
You're
other
not
ones.
Seeing him. Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2264. Mr. Brennan?
Oh, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2264, we heard this measure on the 23rd of February, and it authorized civil and criminal forfeiture of a motor vehicle sold, offered for sale, bought, traded, broker, exchanged, or displayed for sale by persons acting as a vehicle dealer without a certificate. In the intervening time, we've received a Dash 1 amendment that was prepared, and that replaced the original measure, and it specifies that a violation of constitution prohibited conduct for purposes of ORS 131A, and the proceeds of such conduct are subject to civil forfeiture. It specifies that motor vehicles may be seized for forfeiture only if it is displayed for sale by a person in physical possession of the vehicle. The Dash 2 amendment, which we received just earlier today, also replaces the original measure and specifies something similar, but it specifies particularly that only proceeds from the sale of an automobile may be are subject to civil forfeiture, that the vehicle themselves are not subject to forfeiture, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I believe we have Ms. Elliott from Legislative Council with us today to speak to this.
Sure. Yeah, let's do this in the cabinet at the same time.
I believe we also have a representative from the Department of Justice here to speak to this. Would you like to just join us and we can do this all at the same time? Great. Thank you so much.
Please. Chair McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Elliott and I'm here from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I'm primarily here to answer any questions that you may have, or unless you would like me to walk through the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments first.
I would appreciate it if you'd walk okay. through them. This has become a more complex issue, I
okay.
think, than we intended it to. So I think to get everybody on the same page, it would be helpful.
So let's start with the original bill. The original bill simply authorizes forfeiture counsel across the state, so prosecutors, to take advantage of civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture should a person commit the crime of acting as a vehicle dealer without a certificate. The Dash 1 amendments narrow the scope of that to civil forfeiture only, and only when the vehicle is in the possession of the person who is arrested or cited for committing the crime, and for proceeds. The Dash 2s further narrow the scope to simply the proceeds. That's how you
come down to. Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you very much for being here today, yeah. Heidi. On the Dash 1s, can you talk about your understanding of the civil forfeiture procedure? There were questions from the committee, and I've had questions that we've discussed about sort of the innocent, making sure that someone who is giving a vehicle to a dealer who's the nefarious dealer, so to speak, that we heard about at the hearing, on consignment perhaps, that innocent person, just because they're selling their car through a bad actor, doesn't get their car lost. So could you talk about what the civil forfeiture procedure actually is and the remedy, so to speak, that an innocent party would have?
So under Oregon's Constitution, Article 15, Section Article 15, Section 10, and Chapter 131A, in order for a car to be seized for forfeiture, in the case of that, just to go with the example for the person on consignments, say an innocent, truly innocent person offers their car up for consignment. It's now in the hands of the person who has acted illegally under 822.005. Then the car is seized for forfeiture under the Dash 1 amendments because it's on display and offered for sale. Now that car is seized. That person, under the process that's already in place under Chapter 131A, can file a claim to the Forfeiture Council saying, I have an interest in this vehicle. Please keep me informed of all the proceedings. That car cannot be forfeited until the person pretending to be a vehicle dealer without a certificate is convicted of the crime, and the car is considered to be an instrumentality of the crime, and the innocent buyer is found to have acquiesced in that conduct. If the person has not acquiesced in the conduct to truly innocent buyer, then they will get the car back. They would have to file notice and a claim to that property.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the Dash 2s, it would not authorize the district attorney to seize the vehicle, but vehicles that had been sold, they could seize the proceeds, the cash, basically, that the dealer had received from those sales. Is that
check?
Is that correct?
Chair McEwen, Representative Davis, yes, that's correct. We were limited to the proceeds only under this section.
Okay.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Just to step back and talk about civil forfeiture for a minute. In Oregon, as I understand it, we don't do any of that, though, until there's some sort of a conviction. Is that correct?
The way the process works with that, you could seize for forfeiture.
Right.
So the car would be taken. You can't actually forfeit the property until there's been a conviction.
Okay. So that's different
that's
than some states where...
That's under the statutes.
Okay. Because yeah. I know some states, they go, oh, well, we're forfeiting this, and then they do a bunch of stuff. There's maybe not even a charge. And then the person is at the money and basically has lost their vehicle and nothing happened to them. So in this case, it would be normal process, and then after the fact.
Yes, Representative Karen, Representative Gorsuch, yes, that's correct.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Constitution is actually really clear. You may not forfeit without.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair McEwen, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. Our concern here was basically with just the innocent purchasers, and we wanted to make sure that they weren't scooped in the original language of the bill. So we worked with the proponents on the Dash 1 amendments, and we are neutral on the bill, but just didn't want to sweep in the innocent purchasers.
And did you have any comment on the Dash 2?
The Dash 2 would, I just got handed those this afternoon, and our expert wasn't able to make it today, but I think the behavior here that we're trying to, the bill is attempting to get at is to shut down these bad or unlicensed vehicle dealers. And if we don't take the car away, just the proceeds, I'm not sure if that will get at the behavior here all the way. But I think maybe others would have an opinion on that as well. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yep. You have questions for this panel? Did you have questions for Department of Justice?
No, I thank you very much. And I will admit I'm the one who presented the Dash 2s as an alternative, not because I endorse them, but because I just want to have them out there and have them for discussion. I think that in light of the purpose of the bill, not even I, who had them drafted, would be a proponent of the Dash 2s for the purposes I think that DOJ has addressed.
So just to be clear, what I'm hearing both of you say is that the Dash 1 amendments are appropriate. Dash 1 amendments don't have significant legal issues.
Chair McKeown, that is a policy call that I will leave for the committee to decide.
Right. Very carefully said. Yes, Representative McLean.
Okay, well, I'll try. So what you said, though, was that the innocent person, the buyer, the innocent person would not be swept up with the language in the Dash 1.
Chair McKeown, Representative McLean, we believe that is correct.
Okay.
Vice
Chair Davis.
But just one follow-up to make the distinction that these vehicles will be seized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The question is the process that's followed to get them back and whether or not they're actually forfeited. So. Mm-hmm.
And if I may, Chair McKeown, I'm happy to talk with our expert and the representative to get a clearer picture here if we need. So.
Well, I'm getting a sense that this bill is not ready for prime time, that we have a question about the Dash 2s.
Mm-hmm. Dash 1.
The Dash 1 and the Dash 2, in essence.
Yeah.
And so what I might suggest, if the committee is amenable, is that we hold this bill for a little more work, and some conversations can happen in the next few days, and we will revisit it at some point in the future.
Sure.
That sound everybody agreeable?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then, and is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill before we close this hearing? All right. I'm going to close the hearing on the work session. I'm sorry, on House Bill 2264. Do I need to do something official to hold this bill over? We're just going to close it without taking action. All right. Thank you, Senator. Your timing is perfect. Please come join us. I'll open a hearing.
Well, there's a second, Senator.
All right. Thank you. We will open a hearing on Senate Bill 482 and give Mr. Brennan just a moment to let us know what this is about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate 42 authorizes the Oregon Business Development Department to appoint a Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership Advisory Committee to advise the department regarding the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership and economic development manufacturing opportunities within the Willamette Valley and Columbia Valley corridor. It directs the department to provide support to and consult with the partnership, requires the advisory committee and the department to report to the Legislative Assembly during legislative duration of the advisory, during the active duration of the advisory committee beginning January 1st, 2017. This measure comes from the Senate, has no revenue impact and just a minimal fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here this afternoon. We're anxious to hear about this Senate bill.
Great. Getting out of committee meeting.
How about that? We love it when you come visit us.
Yeah. Minimize the number of questions.
All right. Senator Edwards.
I don't know what Senator Olson's got cooking down there.
Something.
Stay
as long as you like. Senator Edwards, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Chris Edwards from Eugene, representing Eugene and Junction City in the state Senate. Senator Thompson and I bring to you Senate Bill 482, the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership Bill. For a little bit of background, there's a federal initiative designed to award communities that demonstrate best practices in attracting and expanding manufacturing opportunities by collaborating to improve the manufacturing ecosystem. This federal initiative called the Investment in Manufacturing Communities Partnership brings together, I believe it's seven agencies, I think that it's seven federal agencies, to work at coordinating technical assistance and programmatic assistance and funding opportunities for local regional partnerships who are also coordinating. And so the city of Eugene brought this opportunity to me because they, in fact, were interested in applying for some of the benefits of the Investment Manufacturing Communities Partnership Program. And lo and behold, there were other communities up and down the I-5 corridor in the Willamette Valley and in the Columbia River corridor and in Southwest Washington that all had the same interest. And so they decided, well, wouldn't it make sense to coordinate? So we're not putting in 10 applications and or 20 or 5 or whatever the number may be, and form the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership Advisory Committee, and that would be housed in Business Oregon. So so they've done that, and really what this is about is creating a better manufacturing ecosystem, taking into account things like workforce training, your supplier network, research and innovation, infrastructure and site development or redevelopment, trade and international investment, and operational improvement and capital access. So those are kind of the categories that we're trying to better coordinate around to improve the manufacturing ecosystem in the region. There is, in fact, an application for federal designation that is due by April 1st. We believe that if the legislature blesses this process and really says this is important work, it'll help get the attention of the Federal Economic Development Authority, the EDA, that is charged with housing this effort. So we believe that better coordination benefits everybody in the region, and it even benefits communities that are outside of the region. And the folks that are coming up behind me that will be following us will tell you a little bit more about that. So overall, we think it's a good effort, and we encourage the support for this effort and as you take it up in the House.
Thank you very much. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, and members of the committee. I'm just here with Chuck Thompson, State Senator, District 26.
Thank you.
I never remembered to do that. My county in the Mid-Columbia, Hood River County, is in an organization called Mid-Columbia Economic Development, which comprises five different counties in the Gorge: Hood River, Wasco, Morrow, Sherman, and a couple counties on the Washington side. And they were pursuing this, and just like Senator Edwards said, they heard that other groups were doing this, because kind of the trouble is you have to be so high up on this federal list to gain this advantage or to be looked at for these this service. So they figured real collaboratively that if they joined enough of these, it would give them a better chance, if they're looking at this at the federal level, to get high enough on the list to take advantage of this. It doesn't preclude other areas in the state for doing the same thing, but you can't have everybody in the state. It's not the whole entire state. It's kind of designed to make up of regions. So this is kind of the first group to do it, and signed on, because it sounds like it benefits a lot of counties up and down through the Willamette Valley and the Columbia Gorge. So hope you support it. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
I would add that when Senator Thompson said you can't just have all of Oregon in it, I mean, he meant that literally. Like, we're not allowed to.
Yeah.
Per federal rule of the program, we're not allowed to designate the entire state as a region. So
the folks that know more are behind us. So
I do have a clarifying question. Would this create the second or the third of these regions? I'm reading this and it says Willamette Valley, Columbia River Gorge, and Portland, Vancouver. Are Portland, Vancouver separate from Columbia Gorge? Is that all one?
That's all one. Those three areas, Southwest Washington, Columbia River Corridor, Willamette Valley Corridor, all one region.
Got it. Okay, great. Thank you.
For purposes of the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership.
Questions for the senators?
Do we have more coming up? That'll...
I believe, do you want to field questions, or would you rather pass them off to the folks who are behind you?
I pretty much trust Senator Olson with my gavel back.
Representative Hack, ask away.
Okay.
All right.
A question or two, but I do want to get back to committee because I actually want to hear the information.
You don't know what you're getting with me then. Sorry. Just kidding. Am I hearing this right, that this is to seek out the designation of the, in order to become part of the investment commission, in management committee partnerships? So you're seeking out to become part of that, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Is it correct that you have to be in the top one-third in the nation to qualify for this? And if so, is that why you chose where you did in the state?
That's a question I haven't been asked, and I don't know. So I'm going to defer that question to the experts coming behind. I actually don't know. What I do know is that this will be the second time that the region has applied, and they were number 13 out of 12 on the last round. So that application as a region.
Senator Thompson.
I'm guessing, but I think it's because they figured they'd have a better shot if they widened the region up and it took in more area, I think.
Right.
But they know the answer.
I have one more.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the designation is given, how long is it good for? How long do we get it?
Oh, man, another question. Answer, too. That is a good question. I don't know.
Madam Chair, I think we should leave now.
I think so. I might agree. Thank you very much for being here, Senators. We will follow up with the next panel. Thank you for being here. All right.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming over. Loved having you.
Answer the good question.
We have Lisa Gardner, David Kenny, and Anne, I'm not going to get this correct, Schmierer. Nice. Thank you for being here this afternoon. We welcome you to our committee, and in any order that you prefer is fine with us.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Gardner. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. Along with the City of Springfield and Lane County, we're members of the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership, or the PNMP. The partnership comprises 17 contiguous counties in Oregon and Southern Washington, extending from Eugene-Springfield metropolitan region north to Vancouver, Portland, east to Hood River, and in the Columbia River Gorge. The partnership is an unprecedented strategic collaboration, formalized with an executed memorandum of understanding in April of 2014. The PNMP formed in response to a federal opportunity, the Investing in Manufacturing Communities Partnership, which aims to accelerate the resurgence of manufacturing in the United States and create a competitive climate for job creation and private investment. Although formed in response to the federal opportunity, the partners agree that the PNMP will be an important tool to address economic prosperity in the region, assisting both urban and rural communities to improve their economic opportunity with or without the federal designation. We did not receive the federal designation in the 2014 IMCP, as you just heard, though we came extremely close. There were 77 applicants nationwide for 12 spots. To use the NCAA bracket terminology, we were a bubble team, and we missed it by a coin toss. The process of creating the partnership and working together on a broad economic development strategy for the region has had lasting benefit. The partnership has built a foundation. The partnership has built a foundation from which we can work to achieve common goals and advance our broad economic development and manufacturing interests. The PNMP reflects the growing recognition of common goals among the communities of the Valley and the Gorge. While our region's innovation and productivity are immense, we confront serious challenges. Our manufacturing workforce is aging, our workforce pipeline is inadequate, median wages in our region are below national averages, while there is growing economic disparity and an erosion of middle-class jobs. A high-performing manufacturing sector contains the promise of well-paying middle-class jobs across urban and rural communities. However, as the labor requirements of manufacturing increasingly resemble those of other high-tech creative industries, our regional integration must increase and our approach to investments must become more strategic. The individual partners of the PNMP face common problems. The different communities throughout the 17-county area all have an aging workforce and an inadequate workforce pipeline. Our wages are below the national average, and our middle-class jobs are eroding. We are all working individually to confront and overcome these issues. By partnering, we can take advantage of each other's technical expertise to understand the causes and the problems and paths toward solutions. The PNMP gives the separate areas a way to learn from each other's efforts and understand successful strategies or challenges. By sharing expertise, research, and training platforms, we benefit each other. The PNMP region shares resources. The labor force is mobile. Education and training in one community may be applied in a different community. In addition, we can link supply chains to manufacturers to deliver component supplies and prevent capital leakage. We can also link trading systems to access new markets. Finally, we'll be able to coordinate funding efforts so we do not compete for funds, but pursue them jointly and increase our chances of receiving those funds. Since last year's notification of our bubble team status, we've been working diligently to improve our application and connect some of the dots on how our emerging expertise and momentum in the advanced materials for advanced manufacturing industry positions us as a deserving manufacturing community. We have met with members of our federal congressional delegation as recently as last week. We have the full support from Congressman DeFazio, as well as Senators Wyden and Merkley, all of whom will be making calls on our behalf to Commerce Secretary Pritzker. A similar bill was heard this morning in the Washington State Legislature. It's our hope that we'll be able to include both Oregon and Washington legislature support in our application. Thank you for your time.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and the rest of the committee for this opportunity to speak today. My name is Ann Schmier. I am the Director of Industry Partnering at Oregon State University and have been participating on the application process with the rest of the team here. I guess I'd like to sort of demonstrate some of the broader impacts of what some of these activities, although they will be in a designated, defined regional area, the broader impacts to the state, and give a couple of examples of the programs that we're working on, primarily some of the good things that we're doing right now, building right now, that will that we could do more of and leverage funding from the federal government to do support these programs. First of all, having just come from the Precision Farming Expo over at the Convention Center, I am actively involved in Oregon State's newly launched Autonomous Systems Research Group, which is involved with advancing unmanned systems broadly. These are aerial systems, some people call them drones, but also other land-based systems as well as marine systems, which will have broad application across the state from the coast all the way over across the state. These initially are being focused on agricultural applications as the topic of the conference today. And I just wanted to, you know, demonstrate how we're working with within the Pan-Pacific UAS Test Range Complex, which the FAA has designated one of six of these across the nation. We have secured one of these through the cooperation of University of Alaska Fairbanks, Oregon State, and University of Hawaii. So those are the three public entities that are involved with the tri-state Pan-Pacific UAS test range complex, of which we have three test ranges that are being established in the state. This is in cooperation and partnership with SOAR and the test ranges across the state. And we really see this as a great opportunity to advance a new technology, a new manufacturing sector, and well over 100 companies in the state that are actively growing in response to this opportunity, with much of the application being in precision agriculture, not only the air systems, but also the land-based systems as well. So that's one example where we feel that leveraging additional support from the federal government will be facilitated through this partnership and will have broader impacts across the state since these companies are located across the state. The second example of some of the support that we anticipate is demonstrated through a collaboration between University of Oregon and Oregon State through our Center for Sustainable Materials Chemistry. This is a NSF-funded center in chemical innovation, and is one of the sort of the top-notch investments that NSF makes in universities. In partnership with the University of Oregon and through our partnership through the entrepreneurship entity RAIN, the Regional Accelerator for Innovation Network, is supporting the sort of pulling these technologies out of the university systems and creating new companies from the technology and innovation that is being derived in these centers. And we feel that you know, being able to work in partnership through the city of Eugene and with the city of Corvallis, as well as our two universities, we see this as a great opportunity to grow companies in the South Willamette Valley. It's all about jobs and translating innovation into new companies, and especially in this sort of green chemistry area, which is very attractive. And I'll turn it over to David to talk about another exciting economic development play in our cross-laminated timber.
Thank you. Mr. Kenny, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. My name is David Kenny. I'm the President and Executive Director of Oregon Best. We're one of the initiatives of the Oregon Innovation Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 482. Oregon Best is a nonprofit organization focused on accelerating research and commercialization of clean technologies in Oregon. And many of the companies that we've been working with over the last several years have grown through the process of technology and product development, are now actually thinking about scale-up and manufacturing. And so this has become, the topic of manufacturing has become really relevant to us as an organization just in the last couple of years. We've been involved in the PNMP, the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership, since its inception last year, and I wanted to give you an example of how that partnership is already driving results. We, as has been mentioned now a couple of times, we weren't successful in winning that federal designation last year, but as a result of that process, the Economic Development Administration's regional office opened a solicitation and invited us as an organization to propose a project that would be specifically utilizing the partnership. And as a result of that, we've applied for an economic adjustment assistance grant from the Economic Development Administration that is being led by Oregon Best but has many partners involved. And it's a $200,000 project titled Advanced Wood Products Manufacturing Study, Cross-Laminated Timber Acceleration in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And it's a project that will utilize the resources of Oregon Best, the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, or OMEP, Impact Washington, Oregon State University's College of Business and its Department of Wood Science and Engineering, Clackamas County, Benton County, Washington State University Center for Innovation and Value Creation, Business Oregon, as well as a nonprofit called Woodworks, and some local workforce organizations. And the focus of that project is to provide insights on the raw material resource, the manufacturing capacity, the capital expense to start up a manufacturing line, the workforce training needs, and the market opportunity for a new engineered wood product called cross-laminated timber, which was developed in Europe and has recently been sort of sweeping the globe as a new building material and style of construction. It's become popular across Europe, more recently in Canada and Australia. And we've been working closely with a manufacturer in Southern Oregon, D.R. Johnson Lumber, that operates Riddle Laminators down in Riddle, Oregon, to become the first manufacturer of structural cross-laminated timber in the United States. And so this particular project is essentially a research project to help provide additional knowledge and insights into market opportunities, as well as what would it take to build this as an industry that Oregon could be a leader in. And architecture community and construction construction firms around the country are very interested in this idea of using cross-laminated timber, which essentially is often described as plywood on steroids, and it's a way of using larger pieces of wood applied in a crosswise manner and glued together to create very large panels that can be up to 10 by 80 feet in size, very strong, and can be used as entire roof panels, floor panels, and wall panels in buildings that would allow buildings to be built in a much more rapid manner on site, where you can basically bring trucks in with these big panels and just use cranes to assemble a building, sort of like Legos. It's very promising and very interesting. And if it takes off in the United States, it will require a lot of wood, and something that we think could be a big boost to Oregon's wood forest products industry. It's really a perfect marriage of advanced manufacturing and utilizing Oregon's manufacturing capabilities as well as our natural resources-based economy. So that's an example. It really came about as a result of this group of partners organizing, and by being organized, we were able to quickly respond. We're waiting to hear on that grant proposal. We're supposed to hear early April, so really in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we expect to hear formally. We've gotten positive indications from them that they would really like to support this grant, and most of the questions have been sort of technical in nature about some of the application details. The only other thing I'd like to add, I guess, is that this particular bill would provide create an advisory committee, but it would really kind of create a designation and a credibility that would support our status with our next national application. And also, I think in any future application coming from the state utilizing this partnership, it really indicates that this is not just a group of partners that is sort of assembled on the spot, but that is created an advisory committee, has created processes in place to work together. And I think there's a lot of credibility when the federal government sees these applications coming in, and you have an organization like this that's been established and been recognized by their state. It I think adds a lot of value and helps to differentiate itself from other applications. So I think I will stop with that, and happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Questions from this panel?
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you. Well, do you want to follow up with Representative Hack? Did you want to ask your questions yet earlier?
I went online and found them, but thank you.
Let's see. Well,
then I have questions on my own.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you. So the partnership has been created, the PNMP. So this bill creates an advisory committee within BISO Oregon. What oomph does that give you? I mean, you're talking about how great the partnership is. Partnership already exists. Mm-hmm. So what does this bill do to help you achieve the goal of getting the federal designation? And if you had that designation, what does that give you?
Sure. Chairman Kuhn, Representative Davis. I think that we decided that we were going to, a year ago, create this partnership and apply for the federal designation. But as we came together and started having conversations around the table with this group of agencies, municipalities, nonprofits up and down I-5 and over to the Columbia River Gorge, it became very apparent that we should have been talking for a lot longer, that for all the reasons we highlighted today, there's benefits in these partnerships. And so at that point, we sort of said, well, we should really codify this regardless of whether we get the federal designation. And that's when we first started thinking about getting a statutory recognition. So asking for that regardless, as David just mentioned, it is really helpful, I think, in our application to show that the states of Oregon and Washington support this effort. I think the question that was asked earlier about how big you have to be or who's applying and things like that, I think that there were 77 applicants last time. They're expecting 86 this time. There's not a specific criteria for geography or scale. It has to be sort of smaller than or larger than a city, smaller than a state, but it could be a region. And so I don't know the specific answer. Representative Heck asked about what third you have to be in, but being of the scale that we are gives us significant standing and opportunity because of the breadth of the types of industries and the ecosystem that we currently have. I think having this statutory recognition just gives us a little bit more weight behind our application, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bentz.
Madam Chair, so we have something like this over in our area on the Idaho border where the two states came together with some of the local communities and put together a partnership. And it's has been, I think this is its third year of attempting to coordinate, if you will, economic opportunities that exist in that area. And it's been about an equal number of problems and that kind of offset the benefits, because there definitely are benefits. What I've observed is that there's lots of folks that would like to be at the table, but there's always this tension of who's actually going to end up with the benefit of whatever the project is. And so although the words are all here, leverage and innovation, all the normal stuff that you see in something like this, when it comes down to it, somebody's going to get the project and somebody not. There is an odd one here and there, like drones or stuff that extend over a space that work. But when you start talking about manufacturing plants that might employ thousands, there's a lot of territorial envy. How's that? Or whatever. So what I'd be worried about on this isn't the hope that is reflected in here, but it's the reality of trying to get a big, huge group of people together and get them all singing the same tune. I would be happier if I saw a list of specific outcomes. The federal one is one. But that just gets you some money to do what? And then all I see are the big words. And, you know, I'm a lawyer. I like big words. But I don't know what happens next. Or how effectively. And so having formed gazillions of organizations and then watch them not do a heck of a lot, except go to a lot of meetings and a lot of talk and everybody jostling for position, I just wonder how you avoid that with this one.
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Bent, I think I'll give an example of how, and Representative Lively is familiar with this. In the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area, we have what's called the Federal United Front. And so certainly when there were earmarks, and even since there have been earmarks, we get together annually to come up with our regional priorities. And so instead of all of us going to each of our members of Congress and asking for a priority project and then having programmatic fix or something like that, we prioritize as a region and we try to work together. And it makes it easier for our delegation to then help us. And then you kind of go down the list and we take turns. And we've been very successful in the long run. I think you're absolutely right. The devil's in the detail, and part of the memorandum of understanding is we get the designation, which is not funding specifically, but it's an opportunity to receive prioritization in existing programmatic funds and grants and appropriations and technical assistance. And so what we have talked about and what I would envision is that we actually have something similar, because currently we can have multiple applicants from the same state or even from the same university, U of O, OSU, applying for one grant, and nobody gets it because it doesn't seem like we're coordinating. So if we try to have a more coordinated, aligned vision about how we do that, and you're right, there's some big words, and we'll have to work out exactly how that happens. But the idea would be that we coordinate. And so cross-laminated timber is a project you heard about today. There are other electronics, sensors. There's other things that are in our application, in our capabilities that we'd like to see happen. And I think the partnership allows us to get together and prioritize how do we seek advantage as a region with federal resources.
Yeah. Representative Bentz.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
One of the things that I see of huge advantage is critical mass of how do we bring all of the best things to bear on these proposals. And you're very right in that we can compete against each other and not be successful, or we can join together and actually be successful on proposals. And I think this has been borne out over and over again, that this will lay the groundwork for doing a number of things that we can bring critical mass to and be more successful, especially if we're given the designation. One of the things that we talk about is what's coming next. And I know that there are some other regional manufacturing initiatives and ideas about how to grow, use this as a foundation to leverage into other very large federal programs, such as the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation, which are $70 million grants that are matched by industry. So we can see how creating a regional focus will give us the foundation to grow even larger programs off of this. So that's kind of some of the ideas about, you know, what's next and what can we use this to leverage even greater proposals into.
Hold on, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the challenge is to figure out where the organization fits. Mm-hmm. So we have this group here called the legislature. It's supposed to be making some sort of plans for the state. And then we have all these other groups and organizations, and they've got little geographically defined areas like counties. We've got these city things. And so when you bring this thing together, you kind of ask yourself, what in the world is it? What power does it enjoy? Who has to pay any attention to it? And the answer almost always is, well, it's a contract. That's why you go immediately to an MOU. You say, okay, we're all going to agree. Well, is it enforceable? Does it have any meaning? And politically, can't we come down to this building and blow it all up? And so the challenge is that when we look at these, and we see a lot of them, whether it's the one that the low carbon fuel standard, for example, was promulgated by, which was a combination of three states and British Columbia. And the idea there is that there's some sort of a bargain among these four states. Well, but it has no legal meaning at all. It has zero. In fact, the document says so. Just to make it totally, you go, who wrote this thing? And so the question becomes, yes, gathering together for the purpose of bringing a federal grant this direction and having critical mass, but a critical mass of what? And as so I would be really interested in seeing where this thing fits in the great scheme of political organizations. So that if something actually happens, we can say, and I know that's why you're asking for some sort of a blessing from this group, so you can ratchet up whatever this thing is to a higher level. Well, what level? That's what I'm struggling with when I see this.
Chairman Kerr,
yes.
President Benz, I think the only answer I have to that question or that comment is there are limited federal resources right now, technical, programmatic, and this is an identified priority that they're trying to help communities across the country reinvest in manufacturing. And so if there are existing resources at the federal level that they're trying to target across the country, we'd like to be one of those areas that they're targeting those resources on. So that's the best answer I have for what does it do for us. It puts the spotlight on Oregon instead of Kentucky and Maine, my home state, and other places across the country. It allows them to take the limited resources and funnel some of that into our state, into Southwest Washington. And so that's why we're pursuing it.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did find an answer to the question in regards to the designation. If you are to receive the grant, it's a two-year designation, and then you have to reapply again. So I, too, would be concerned just about whether or not when we're going to get it and then what happens in a two-year time period. But in addition to that, so did you make it to phase two of that? Do you know that you made it into phase two to even be considered?
So, Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, we are currently among those applying for the second round. So the first round was designated a year ago. There were 12 communities identified. Those communities are off and running. There will be 12 new communities designated as part of this round two. We'd like to be part of that.
Representative Hack.
I have to disclose I'm a grant writer. So what phase two means is that you've made it past the first cut.
No.
Do you know if you've made it past the first cut or not?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, there's only one new mm-hmm. field.
Right.
And so we are in along with the other 80 communities that are applying. It's not specifically a grant that we're applying for, we will be receiving. But we
the
have
the designation
not
then.
Right. We have not missed anything yet. We are still in the running as anybody who is either first time or second time applicant as part of the second round of designations.
Okay. Can I have a follow up?
Yes, you may.
So the application part, when I read through the qualifications, it talks about making it into the second phase. So there may need to be some clarification there at some point. But part of one of the key features in this is talking about public and private and the strengths and partnership. So I have a little more question in that regard and how you feel that you've provided that. If you could maybe touch a little bit more on that, because that's a key component of the success of whether or not you get the designation.
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Hack, I just clicked for me what the phases that you're referring to are. In 2013, there were eight communities that were designated, and there was money available, and I believe that The Columbia River Gorge was one of those first designations to receive some money to begin an initial assessment of their eligibility for manufacturing communities. Then there was the next round, which was the 2014 application. So we're not going through that same phasing this time. Everybody's applying for this, so we're in that. And I don't know if I think maybe David might be a better person to speak to your second question.
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, the public-private partnership model is definitely sort of the model that the Obama administration has been utilizing to try to advance this larger competitiveness manufacturing initiative that this is part of. And one of the highlight programs has been this national network that Ann just referred to a minute ago, this national network, it's NNMI, I know the acronym, but National Network of Manufacturing Institutes. And there are tens of millions of dollars a piece. They've rolled out several of them. Parts of our entities, including Oregon State University, was actually a subcontractor to one of the winning proposals out of Illinois. They require a very large private sector involvement. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges we have in Oregon, frankly, in any of these big major national initiatives, is we don't have a large private sector to tap into. When we were looking at Chicago, Detroit, I was just at a meeting a couple of weeks ago where they were bragging about having 350 R&D centers in the state of Michigan for various corporations, and we've got a small handful, at two or three companies that make up that kind of comparable number. And so we often struggle in these kinds of things to have a large private sector presence in terms of committed resources in organizing these types of proposals and initiatives. We do have engagement through a lot of the partners, including Oregon Best, including the universities, including each of the cities that's participating. They have private sector relationships. And I think as specific opportunities come up after this designation, we will have greater success in recruiting them to participate in specific proposals. Because this first designation is really just the start. The real opportunity then lies in individual solicitations that are awarded by various agencies, and depending on whether it's related to thin film electronics manufacturing or food processing or any other thing, we will utilize these relationships to bring a lot of those private sector partners to bear.
Yes. Thank you, and that's why I asked that question, because I know we struggle with that. And while I appreciate that work is yet to come, that will be such a key component of whether or not you get the designation that I'm not sure that won't be a huge barrier for you in getting the designation. So while I understand you're going to develop that as time goes, that may be a huge deterrent as far as you being able to get your designation. One of the other pieces, while I love the advanced wood products, your testimony in regards to the lamination of the wood, I think that's really innovative and I love it. One of the other key components of the designation is that you don't start a new program from scratch. They want to see you working on what you've already done. And part of that, what I raised earlier on being top three in the nation, is that you're proving that you've got commitment and buy-in from community and support, and you're taking something that you've already got and you're making it better and being innovative. They don't necessarily look favorably upon brand new. So how did you address that in your proposal, and do you believe that will affect your designation? Because I'm kind of feeling like we've got some strikes against us right out of the gate, and if we're looking at implementing your putting this together for your group, and that's a driving force behind why we're looking at this, and we've already got two out of the three major components against us, I'm concerned about that.
I'd like to,
in regards to the designation piece.
Yeah, Madam Chairman and Representative Hack, I respectfully disagree with the level of participation and engagement that we have with our industry sector. Through the Oregon's Metal Initiative and through the Northwest Collaboratory, we have a number of great collaborations with Blunt, emerging one with Daimler, and a number of different companies around the state that we're using as foundation of longstanding relationships that we have, not only for innovation, but also in workforce development and their hiring our students right into their companies. So, and addressing the workforce, refreshing the workforce in some of these companies. So, I think that I'm very confident with the level of engagement that we have right now, and I'm encouraged by being able to partner more with our folks on other EDA grants and other solicitations that will come down the line that will be sort of sector-specific, with cross-laminated timber being one, UAVs being another. You know, a number of these different companies, we work with them in different capacities. And so I think that we have a lot of really positive things to propose in this solicitation.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hack. I would also just point out that while the partnership is a new entity as in terms of signing an MOU, these initiatives, including the ones that Ann Schmier just mentioned, are not new. And we actually have a multi-year track record of engagement around a lot of different manufacturing sectors. The food processing industry in Oregon has been organized for, I think the Food Processing Association just celebrated 100 years or something as an entity. And the semiconductor industry has been partnering with our universities and with the local governments in this region that we're talking about for decades as well. And so We're connecting a lot of very long-standing relationships, and while the partnership itself is new, I don't think we're creating something brand new as a concept.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Vice Chair Gorsuch and then Representative McLean.
Well, I have one question. I mean, it sounds like a very interesting project, and it sounds like a nice collaboration. I am interested in how much time would be required of the Oregon Business Development Department in terms of talks about advising. It also talks about providing support to and consultation with the partnership. What do you think time and cost would be for something like this within that department?
Chair McKeown, Vice Chair Gorsuch, I'll take a first shot at that. I can't specifically answer Business Oregon's
time. Sure, right.
But I can tell you is from our conversations and our partnership, and as David mentioned, a lot of this is there are existing relationships, existing work, existing plan items that are happening, that are already part of the budget, part of the process, and we're linking them in a way that gives us greater strategic and competitive advantage. And so one of the things in this application, and as Senator Edwards and I both mentioned, we were 13th. We were right on the bubble. And it was really, the skin of our teeth that we lost by. One of the questions they had was, how are we linking our various technologies? So most of the other communities that were designated last time focus on one key industry. And that's more tech, that's more typical. We're actually being slightly more innovative and focusing on key technologies. So our industry is advanced material sciences for advanced manufacturing. And we made a very good case, but they were trying to figure out exactly how are we linking and connecting all these dots, because it's across multiple, the technologies that we're developing at OSU and U of O and at the various research agencies are applying to aerospace, to running wear, to food and beverage, food and beverage science, to wood products. And so we are really just fine-tuning our application, answering some of the questions. And so we were so close. I think the work of Business Oregon, that their existing work, it really parallels with this. And they're housing it because we needed one applicant, and it was logical to have them be the applicant. Most of the work is happening in the sort of satellite agencies and municipalities and nonprofits.
Did you have a follow-up?
No,
Representative McLean.
It looked so simple on its face. I think this has been a really good dialogue, as far as really looking at the overall short and long-term perspective, and I think that's what you're hearing. You're hearing it makes sense short-term, long-term, where does it take us and what does it cost, and what are the relationships that are being formed here with this passing, and would those relationships cause more confusion or would it cause more glue to help everyone rise, and do a better job and continue to coordinate. And I support I personally support this because I think it's positive every time you communicate, discuss, and you bring together partners. And I'm delighted to know that there's still some federal money and a federal goal that basically is really trying to bring back a resurgence of manufacturing in the United States. So I want to say that right off the top. If they've still got that goal and a little bit of grant money or a little bit of support money, well, I think we better be part of the group that's looking for that opportunity. But I do think that this is a group that doesn't have what some of these other groups already have. Transportation, both statewide and regionally, have JPAC, and they have the Transportation Legislative Body, and other parts of business have, I think, used the same department that you're wanting to use. They've already used it, and they're using it exactly the same way. To demonstrate relationship, to demonstrate ability to work together, to demonstrate innovative connections and partnerships. And I think manufacturing has been left out of it over and over and over again. And so I was delighted to see something, first of all, with your area, secondly, with research universities as well as business and, you know, the companies, and new ideas for products and think type, you know, activities. And so it makes sense to me. But I think they have real questions with real needs for real answers. And so we've got to understand, you know, if there has been a perspective, you know, by the department, if there has been a perspective by your partnerships in your organization and the relationships that you've already made and used, you know, to think about those long-term implications. So that wasn't really a question, but I sat and listened for like an hour, right, almost. And to me, that's what they're saying. They're asking really good questions about really important things that you care about as much as the legislator body cares about. So if there's anything there you can answer, that's great. But thank you.
Representative Lively, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I have a couple comments to make. Somebody that's been involved in this for a long time. First, I could just say the credit goes, and I appreciate what Representative Benz was saying, but how far we've come. And so part of what's lost in this conversation today is how far we've come. And the first application is a great example of the collaboration and put together to even make that application, because I was involved early on having those conversations. And I can tell you, it wasn't that many years ago that we in Springfield, anyway, wouldn't even work with Eugene, let alone work with Portland to put an application. But what we've all recognized is the playing field is very different. And the opportunities, because the playing field's different. And I just want to reinforce that there is a lot of collaboration going on with the private sector amongst these efforts. I've been involved in many of those, and I'll just pick on the cross-laminated timber. There's huge opportunities there, and one of the things my community is excited about is first a resurgence in our timber industry, but because we have an opportunity soon in the state to do some demonstration, we're excited about doing that because we believe if they can get that started there, it not only provides opportunities to bring that technology to Springfield and some of that, but we have some opportunities right now for using the materials. And my community is excited about being able to use the materials, but we've got to go through. So it takes a lot of people involved with that. It takes the research. It takes changes to our regulations and rules that allow us to do this. And it takes somebody to be able to produce it. And so to me, a lot of that's happening. It's hard to explain how far we've come in a short period of time. But I think this is an important step because I don't think we're backing up. Mm-hmm. We're not going to go back to the old days where we're in our separate silos and doing it. This is for all kinds of different reasons why we've had to get to this point. And so to me, this is just kind of the next statement. It kind of reinforces all the efforts that have been made to date to bring it there. But it's still hard to get your hands around it, what it is. But having worked in the trenches for 30 years, we're light years, and there is an enormous amount of collaboration going on with the private sector that are part of this. And they'll step up more than they've already stepped up, but a lot of that is going on in our area.
Thank you, Representative. I have a couple of questions I'd like to throw out, and I really appreciate this discussion. I think it's a very important discussion, and to Representative Lively's point, I do believe that there's a cultural shift in how we work together in the public and private sector. It's very different than it was a decade or two ago, and that's the direction we ought to be taking. The cross-laminated timber issue is a darling of this session. Everybody loves it. We like the architectural aspects, the design aspects, you know, using our wood products. Effectively, I'm very familiar with D.R. Johnson's operation, and they're doing a fantastic job, and we appreciate that work. And of course, I've been in ag for a while. UAVs have been a topic of conversation now for a couple of years, and we have a tremendous opportunity in this state to grow that industry, and I'm really glad that we're seizing it and moving on. But there are a couple of things that you brought up that I want to push on just a little bit. Another darling of this session is the word rural. And we know that in our urban communities that the tide is rising, and we know it's not in our rural communities. And I heard you reference a kind of casting a rural net with this. And I hear valley, and I hear metro, and I hear gorge. So I would like to know a little bit more about what you actually mean when you say casting a rural net, and how this can possibly impact our rural communities.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I'm really excited about the opportunity to have such a direct impact of some innovative wood product research that is going to translate directly into revitalizing several rural communities. Quite frankly, I feel like all of the stars have kind of aligned on this one, because there's the market pull that people want to use these panels in. You know, that it's, you know, much more carbon friendly. It sequesters carbon. It's a renewable resource, and it's a lower carbon footprint than concrete and steel, and in the state of Oregon is like the perfect place to grow trees. So, you know, I just feel...
However, somebody has to let us into those forests to cut those trees.
Exactly, yes. So I think that, I mean, it brings up, you know, some of the larger issues about, you know, how many trees are we going to cut? But I think as far as the opportunity, the market pull, the... economic development aspects of this for rural communities, I just feel that this will be kind of a tipping point in making that investment in the harvesting of trees. And really, trees are, you know, quite frankly, a crop now in a lot of ways. People don't like to come out and say that.
They have been for a very long time for a lot of us.
Yeah. And I think that by creating this new exciting building material, the public will understand how this resource should be used, and to create a higher margin product instead of just shipping our logs to China or to some other state who will make the cross-laminated timber. Somebody else will make these if we don't. So why not capture the higher margin product for jobs in our state, create a new manufacturing sector? And I just feel that, you know, that this is going to happen, and let's make it happen in Oregon.
Well, I certainly agree with you that as this industry develops, we would like to have it here.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go one step further. Can you explain how you are defining your manufacturing sector, and what limitations on types of manufacturing come with this? With this coalition. So what are we limited to? What are you looking towards?
Chairman, I'll start and I'll see if anybody else wants to jump in. I think one thing I want to really clarify is that our industry, as I said before, is advanced material sciences for advanced manufacturing, and it crosses a multitude of sectors, whether it's electronics, food and beverage industry, cross-laminated timber or other products.
Sportswear.
The application this time has asked us to feature a catalytic project. And so for purposes of illustrating how we can come together and work, we are choosing CLT as our catalytic project. It is not what the application is all about. It's not all we're going to be focusing on, but we're putting the spotlight on it for purposes of illustrating sort of the whole range of research, innovation, materials, product, supply chain, workforce training, and then manufacturing. So we're not limiting. What we're limited to is the participants' expertise and interest. So if we get this designation, Southwest Washington can continue focusing on something that may have nothing to do with cross-laminated timber.
Mm-hmm.
It allows those of us to pursue what we want to pursue. And so that's the best answer I have on that particular question. Backing up to your question about the rural piece, I think it's widespread, because if we can create new manufacturing opportunities, new supply chains that go, whether it's nationally or exporting, we're looking at ports, Port of Portland, Port of Coos Bay. There are manufacturing jobs. There's export opportunities. And so the rural piece really is undefined, but there's tremendous potential because whether it's the Sweet Home mill site or other mills that may be redeveloped, reused, retooled. And then I think cross-laminated timber, and David's by far the expert on this, I'm not, but it's a more sustainable source than our traditional milling, cutting, and shipping. It's using different level of materials. It's compressing them. It's getting sort of more bang for the buck, and it's a more renewable source of building materials.
Sure. I'll add to that. And
honestly, I understand cross-laminated timber, and I don't mean to drill down on that any further than we absolutely have to. I'm delighted that Valerie Johnson's business is expanding because of this, and I hope that, you know, we can open other cross-laminated timber manufacturing centers across the state. I wanted to know what the next step is beyond cross-laminated timber, and if it's high tech, if it's, you know, when I hear those words, that doesn't help us out in the hinterlands put our people to work. And I think this is a fabulous idea. I'm supportive of what you're trying to do. I just don't want to lose sight of the conversation that lets us who are out in these very small rural communities that are struggling mightily, how do our people participate in what you're trying to do? It's very difficult when it's centered in the valley and in the metro area, and I understand our students come out of our communities and go to Oregon and Oregon State, and they can get involved in research projects. But when you look at the actual rural economic revival that we need, I'm not sure you help us. And so I'm just, these don't concern me at all. I think what you're doing is really good work. I just don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's another part of Oregon that's still struggling, and I'm not sure this helps us. We don't need to go any farther than that.
Okay. I'd like to make just one comment, which is that one of the catch-22s that I think exists with all of these federal programs is to even propose something, you have to develop a proposal that's specific to what they're asking for.
Right.
And we're doing that. I think, you know, the value of this is in this group of participants starting a conversation with each other and formalizing it in a way that we are engaging in new ways. And, you know, a couple of people on the committee have already commented on the value of that collaboration and how that's something that didn't exist even 10 years ago. And I think if that continues, what we'll see is that the advanced, you know, materials is like people have forgotten about that in a couple of years.
True.
When some other opportunity comes
else.
Along. And we'll be onto something else.
Yeah.
But those relationships are really the key. And, you know, from a rural perspective, you know, it is hard, right? And you know, I think, you know, we would have solved it as a state by now if it was easy.
Granted.
I think, though, you know, there are lessons that can be learned from region to region. And I've learned a little bit in the last year about what a great job the food processing industry has done in Morrow County area, Boardman, Hermiston area, of ensuring that food doesn't leave there until value has been added to it. And they've, you know, we don't sell onions unless they've been sliced and processed and packaged here. And I think the forest products industry, you know, could do a lot, you know, down that path. And I think, you know, CLT is one of many advanced engineered wood products that I think we could, you know, continue to be a leader in. And I would love to see it to be a start of an innovation movement in the wood products industry that, you know, helps to eliminate raw log imports or exports, I mean, which is, you know, one of those things I think we'd all would love to see a shift in that. And I think this is one of those things that can contribute toward that. And I think it's all about these relationships. And that's not about advanced materials innovation necessarily, but I think that transfer of what's happened in Boardman to what's, you know, to the forest products industry comes through these kinds of networks and relationships. And while this region is limited in its scope, I mean, you know, as soon as it gets going, you're going to see more and more parties and counties and others getting involved.
Good.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one piece to that.
Sure.
Because I was remiss in not mentioning food processing or not featuring it more broadly, because I think some of the sciences that whether it's high tech, sensors, those contribute to that food processing opportunities. So, and I was reminded that Senator Thompson mentioned his area is looking at pear puffs as a new food product. But there's agriculture, there's wine and beer and many, many agricultural products that are
fermentation sciences.
Fermentation, exactly.
We're all over that one.
So that's all part.
We like them all.
It's all included in what we can do here under this opportunity.
Great. And I appreciate what you're trying to do. I do. So thank you for indulging me. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Great. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it very much. Anybody else want to comment on this fascinating topic? Then I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 482. And we're done with that. And we will move on to open a work session on House Bill 2266. Mr. Brennan?
So House Bill 2266, Madam Chair, we heard this bill originally.
On
February 23rd, it specifies that vehicle dealers may be exempted from weight mile taxes when operating a vehicle under control by the dealer. The vehicle is plain dealer plates and is being operated for test driving purposes while unloaded. We don't have any amendments to this bill. At the time, we had not received a fiscal revenue impact statement. However, we have received a statement of no fiscal impact. The revenue impact statement is a hall pass because this measure has a subsequent referral to committee on revenue because there will be some revenue implications to the measure because of the weight mile tax issue. So that's where we are, Madam Chair.
We'll look for a motion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
You both have to.
That's
you can do the next one.
How are
you
doing? I'm not worried about it. I just started
looking at each other.
We have a little confusion.
Yeah, it's fine.
Representative Davis moves House Bill 2266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
What do you got?
We'll do better next time. If not, the motion passes, and the measure is sent to revenue. Okay.
Nice work.
Let's see. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2266, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2886. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure we heard the same day, the 23rd of February. It provides clarification regarding who may participate in vehicle dealer auctions or display of vehicles without holding a valid vehicle dealer certificate. We have no amendment to this measure. This measure does not have subsequent referral, so we have received a minimal fiscal impact statement and no revenue impact statement as a measure is ready to move as the committee sees fit.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan.
Okay.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Chair McKeown, I move House Bill 2886 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gorsuch moves House Bill 2886 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Chair McKeown?
Oh.
Rep. Lane?
Yes.
Rep. Benz?
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Chair?
Aye. The motion passes. Do we have a volunteer to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Representative Gorsuch. Vice Chair Gorsuch's happy to carry the bill.
You bet.
Thank you very much. Unless there is anything for the good of... let's see. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2886. And I believe there's nothing else for the good of the order this afternoon.
Do we want to preview?
And I will ask Mr. Brennan to tell us what is going to be happening on this Friday. We have a full agenda Friday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have hearings on two bills dealing with studded tires. Amy Joyce from DMV ODOT is going to provide us a briefing on the license plate programs because the following Monday we'll be dealing with license plate bills. And then we're going to have work sessions on seven bills on this Friday, Madam Chair.
Oh.
So we'll need lots of carriers on Friday. And on that note, we are adjourned. And on that note, we are adjourned. We need lots of carriers on Friday.